From Illinois Soul, this is Dialogue. I'm Kennedy Vincent. Dialogue is an exchange about culture, straight from the soul. You can catch us on Saturday mornings at 11 and Tuesdays at 7 p.m. on Illinois Soul. Black sacred music, Negro spirituals, gospel hymns are all a genre of Christian music that has been sung by generations of ancestors and centuries of congregations across the world. It's more than just voices harmonizing and a choir coming together. It's a powerful celebration of resilience and faith. This is the Black Chorus performing at their previous symposium. As vocals leave the stage to transfer to the audience, stories are shared, resilience is remembered, and many reflect on the transformative power of sacrifice and survival.
Black sacred music to me means strength. I think it's something that we go to in times of trials and times of tribulation. It's something that we could reach in and grab for encouragement. Yeah, I just enjoy celebrating Black sacred music.
That's exactly why Dr. Ollie Watts Davis founded the Black Sacred Music Symposium 18 years ago. This year, the symposium embodies the word pillar, as the chorus gives recognition of the strength this music carries amidst our current era of global uncertainty. Reginald Payne brings 14 years of choral experience with the Black Chorus to his role now directing the Yale Black Seminarians. He's returned to Urbana-Champaign for this year's symposium and told me about how the event works and why it's so important.
Black sacred music essentially to me means music that's derived from spiritual text. For me, that's a Christian text. But for others, that could mean Jewish texts or Muslim texts. The sacred music that we're performing is predominantly Christian sacred music by Black Americans. The really exciting thing about the symposium is that most of the artists who are coming are writing, composing this music for the groups that are here on campus, and they learn it in the 3 days and present it on the Sunday. And I'm grateful. For me, it's a legacy. It's a tradition that I've been raised up in. It's not something that I take lightly, even though it comes easy to me. It's something that I'm passionate about, and I would love to share it with everyone. As you mentioned, I'm the choral conductor for the gospel choir at Yale, and I invite everyone. People tell me all the time, I can't sing. I would love to join, but unfortunately, I don't sing. I said, that's going to make it even more fun. And I really do believe that it makes it more fun, but it also reinforces parts, right? So I'm like, we need you, right? So because people who come in and they don't have any necessary relationship with music, but other than loving it, they come in, they're like, I don't know how to use my voice. Just sing the notes I'm giving you. It's not too complicated. I want everybody to know it's accessible. Everyone can sing this music. Sometimes people feel like, oh, this is Black sacred music. I'm not Black, so I can't sing this music. Not true. This is a tradition that's very inclusive, welcomes everyone. Even something like Lift Every Voice and Sing, Black National Anthem, National Hymn, however you want to call it. I know there's been some controversy over the term, but it was written in 1900, dedicated to Abraham Lincoln because of the Emancipation Proclamation. And Lift Every Voice and Sing isn't necessarily derived from spiritual text, but I think it's just as inspiring, right? The sacredness of being human, the sacredness of coming together, of community, of relationship. Relationship, lifting our voices together and remembering our history.
Black sacred music has a long, rich history here in America. I sat down with Dr. Ollie Watts Davis, distinguished singer, professor of music, and the founding director of the Black Sacred Music Symposium, to talk about the history behind this music and what it means to preserve and celebrate Black cultural traditions.
I believe that the Black sacred music tradition came when the first enslaved Africans landed in 1619. I believe that while they weren't able to bring material culture with them, they could bring immaterial culture. They could bring their memories, their mores. They could bring their values, and they could bring their music, and they did bring their music. And so I believe from the retention that we have today with the actual music form, the sometimes the manner of teaching the music and learning the music, the call and response or antiphonal style, that's all a retention from our ancestors from the continent of Africa. Mm-hmm. Our preference for certain tessitura or pitches of the male voice and the female voice, the use of the extended chest voice to elicit a certain response or to express a certain feeling, I think that also is a retention.
Gods are gonna trouble the water.
The leader looks like the Israelite.
Gods are gonna trouble.
So this music, as I said, it came as a seed in 1619, and it just took root. It just germinated. And music in this tradition is functional. It's beautiful. It's pleasing to the ear, but it serves a purpose. And I think that also is a retention from our ancestors on the continent. So it depends on what we were experiencing. When we came here first, we came here as workers. And so there were the work songs and the music, the text would serve the purpose that was needed for. But I believe that there was always a spirit on that music, a spirit to form community, a spirit to communicate. And so even though it was maybe a secular form, there was also a sacred aspect to it as well.
When we think of Black sacred music, we typically relate it to Christianity, gospel music, worship music. But what ties Black sacred music to ancestors isn't only context of the song, but it's also the ways it's performed.
And the music just continued to develop to serve as, again, the purpose. So you have the secular traditions, you have the sacred traditions. My research interest in what features is the sacred music traditions. So we start with spirituals. And we know the history of spirituals and how they were disseminated by the Fisk Jubilee singers back in the 18th and early 19th century. And then depending, again, what was happening sociologically, music started to evolve. So we not only have the spirituals, but then we have, once reading and literacy came, we had the adoption of hymn singing. But it was done in a style that reflected the values of the African-American or the Black tradition. So I call them improvised hymns. And then we kept evolving to gospel music during the Depression era. And probably the most famous gospel song during that era was by Thomas Dorsey, who's noted as the father of gospel music, with His Precious Lord.
All right. Let's go. Delicious Lord, I love your name. When I
Dr. Davis talks about the oral traditions brought over from Africa that are weaved throughout Black sacred music. It made the dialogue team wonder what God and cultures those traditions came from that we continue to honor throughout song today. Christianity in Africa can be traced as far back as the 1st or 2nd AD, and Islam as far as the 7th century. With how widespread Islam and Christianity were in Africa by the 1600s, people who were forcibly brought here during the North Atlantic slave trade would have been Christian and Muslim. But many during that time were of indigenous polytheistic practice too. For example, West African Vodun is an old religion. It centers around the existence of a supreme creator divinity, with lesser deities that are associated with specific areas. When it was brought to the Americas, the cultural practices passed down inspired the creation of Louisiana and Haitian voodoo. Also, on the West Coast is the religious practice of Yoruba. Yoruba and religious factions based on this religion are practiced around the world due to the large displacement of its people during the slave trade. Traditional Yoruba beliefs hold that all people experience ayanmo, which is destiny or fate. As a part of this, there is an expectation that everyone will eventually achieve the state of Olodumare, which is becoming one with the divine creator who is the source of all energy. In the Yoruba religion belief system, life and death is an ongoing cycle of existence in various bodies. In Aye, the physical realm as the spirit gradually moves towards transcendence. Playing right now is traditional Yoruba worship music by Paul Thomason and Dare Justified. So whether monotheistic or polytheistic, Black sacred music echoes that of many cultures today.
So I want for the audience and everyone to know that the music has a function, it serves a purpose. And we continue to go through our journey in this country, and whatever we were experiencing sociologically, we were responding with music. See, this music has served as a shelter, and it has served as, has set a standard for us to express our feelings and our values. It serves as a shield. I often call the music of Black Americans armor, armor for my trauma. And so it, again, being functional, serving a purpose. And, you know, as we continued, the civil rights movement came about, and our hymns and our spirituals were repurposed to basically address what we were experiencing. So the spiritual that may have said, ain't gonna let nobody turn me around, you know, became ain't gonna let Bull Connor turn me around, or whatever the social circumstance was. Again, the music was repurposed and used for that specific existential situation. We get into the 70s and the 80s, and we have this emergence of gospel music. And I believe a turning point was when the Hawkins family out of Oakland, California, released their very engaging gospel song, Oh Happy Day.
Oh, happy day.
And that was a real transition period. And we just continued to develop from there to where we are now with urban gospel, traditional gospel as well, urban soul gospel.
So promise me you'll never part, 'cause I'm lost without you.
Easy to see.
I'm lost without you.
Even to hip-hop gospels. But I guess I want the listener to know that the music, although beautiful and aesthetically pleasing, also served the people. And so in my teaching, I impress upon the students, learn the music well. Give yourself over to the music. Be committed to an authentic interpretation of the music. And as you journey through your life, the music will serve you. Mm-hmm. And it's proven to do so.
Your performances often carry historical significance, a few of what you just mentioned, from Lincoln-era concerts to Florence B. Price's legacy.
Yeah.
How do you approach the responsibility of bringing these important cultural moments to life for contemporary audiences?
Oftentimes I'm asked, how do you select what you're going to sing? And at this point, I get to sing what I want to sing. So in selecting repertoire, songs, or even accepting invitations as the ones you mentioned, I always start with, what do I want to say? I'm committed to the message And then I pull together all the forces that I need, my technique, my voice, my intellect, my enthusiasm, to actually deliver that message. It's very important to me to do that. And so once I've determined what I want to say, I then look at the platform I've been given. So as you know, I'm a professor in the School of Music here at Illinois, and also an associate dean, and also a conductor, and I'm a performer. And so it doesn't matter which platform I find myself on, I'm very committed to the story, the message. I was telling my students just the other day, this is a very good song that I'm teaching you. And I asked them, do you agree that this is a good song? And they agreed. And then I said, well, then you have to become good storytellers because you have to deliver the song with integrity, the music and the message. And I'm going to give you the technique or the method for which to do it.
Mm-hmm. For yourself and for your choir to deliver these stories and these messages, what is the liberation that you feel within your own spirit?
It's a little emotional for me, but it's very important. So bear with me.
Mm-hmm.
The music that I am so privileged to present, specifically the music from Black America, whether it's as a conductor or as a solo artist, has a tremendous story. I'm standing on the shoulders of my ancestors. And so I take it with a great deal of respect and reverence. And again, if I need to say something, I think, what did my ancestors say about this situation I find myself in? So let me go talk to them. Let me pull out literature from the Harlem Renaissance or other eras. Let me see what Langston Hughes had to say, or James Baldwin, or County Cullen, you know, some of my favorite Black poets, because they spoke to their moments. And I find myself in a moment now, how can I build on what has been said? I oftentimes think that nothing new really needs to be said. Sometimes we need to just rehearse or rehear what has been said because it will fit the circumstance we find ourselves in. And so in 2020, after we had this tragedy that happened in Minnesota.
George Floyd's death sparking protests across the country.
Who do you serve? Who do you protect? Who do you serve?
I thought, what can I say to this? What do I have to say? How can I use my platform? So I designed and developed a solo recital, and it was called Toward Justice and Shared Humanity, The Art Songs of Black Americans. And I went to my library in my home, and I pulled out poetry, and I started reading my favorite poets, Langston Hughes, County Cullen, James Alden Johnson, and I let them speak to me. And then I thought, there are art songs for solo voice, my voice, and piano accompaniment. And I can curate a recital. And by singing this music, delivering it with integrity, I won't have to say anything. I'll use my instrument, my voice. I'll use my intellect, my presence, my commitment, and I'll let the music speak. And so I've been so privileged to perform this recital about 12 times across the country. And then I always have a talk back afterwards just to see how the audience received it and how what impression it made on them and take any questions they may have for me. It's been wonderful. It's been so fulfilling and rewarding. It's been my responsibility and privilege to stand up for justice and righteousness and equity by using my gifting.
Here is Dr. Davis performing Give Me Jesus after H. Johnson with the Jupiter Spring Quartet. Throughout your career, you've broken barriers in music while maintaining deep connections to sacred music and community service. What guidance would you offer to young artists trying to honor both their classical trainings and their cultural heritage?
Learn your craft. Study. Be diligent. Preserve your instrument. Take really good care of it. Protect your health, because your health is so important in your delivery. Read a lot. Expand your imagination. Because in order to be an effective performer, you've got to see it before the audience sees it. If you don't see it, they'll never see it. But if you can show them that you have something in mind, in sight, they'll be curious enough to pay attention to you. And so I think that using all of you, your entire self, your intelligence, your health, your instrument, your strength, your heart, your commitment is very important. I would say don't chase stardom. Really be committed to effectiveness. And I would also say be generous. Add value to the human condition and offer your music and your art as a gift. Because most people enjoy receiving gifts. And if you offer it as a gift, a one-way transaction, then I think that you'll receive the applause that you're looking for. Only you know how hard you work in the studio, in the practice room. And work as hard as you need to work in order to, you know, develop and have a mature offering to give. And then be pleased with the opportunity. Life is something that doesn't happen to us. It's something that happens for us. And so opportunity has a tendency to not repeat itself. When opportunity comes your way, be prepared for it.
I speak of promised land, soil as soft as mama's hands, running water, standing still, endless fields of daffodils and chamomile, rice under black beans, walked in the apple with cracked screens and told prophetic stories of freedom, found warmth in a black queen for when I get cold like Nat King, I'm doing the dad thing. I speak of wondrous, unfamiliar lessons from childhood, make you remember how to smile good. I'm pre-currency, post-language, anti-label.
Reginald Payne is an example of a pupil that has taken advice and influence from Dr. Davis. As an alumni of both the University of Champaign-Urbana and the Black Chorus, he's currently in his Arts and Religion Master at Yale. We spoke about why he returned for this year's symposium and the impact this work has had on his life.
In a place like Yale, it's the Ivy League, and the spaces are predominantly Caucasian, just practically, right? Not a judgment call, but that's just what it is. And so when I came, there was no gospel choir. It was inactive. There had been a gospel choir, but they couldn't get things together. And I mentioned that I did music and people were like, oh, you should think about conducting the choir. And I was like, oh, I don't think so. So the first semester I said no. And then a professor, Dr. Braxton Shelley, who's actually going to be at the conference this weekend, he had a program there at Yale, and it was called Art Testimony. It was how you get music that has a story, right? It's usually somebody's personal story, and they will sing their song, and sometimes we sing their story, but that's what the whole idea was about, right? They had this evening program, and he brought in people from all over the country to come and sing and share music from this Black sacred music tradition. And everyone responded so enthusiastically to it. And people were literally jumping, leaping out of their seats because they enjoyed the music so much. And that's when I thought, okay, maybe there's a contribution I can make, right? Not thinking like, oh, I can handle everything. You can just take your cues from me. Not really thinking like that, but really trying to create that feeling for people, you know, create that space where they can express themselves, because the nature of Ivy Leagues are so intense. There's not often spaces for you to release, to let go, to unwind. And I feel like this music gives us an opportunity to do that.
So between pursuing a Master of Arts in Religion and Music and your time with the choirs, music is everywhere in your life. When did your passion for the arts start?
My senior year of high school, the Clark Atlanta Philharmonic Society was on tour. and they came to my high school. I've heard spirituals in church. People would sing them. It would be like a solo thing, but it wasn't organized music, you know, where there's a composer who's planned it out. This is the end that they're going for. This is the sound that they want because of X, Y, or Z. That was my first introduction to that. And I was amazed because the dynamics were so intense. They would get so quiet and then they would get so loud. It's almost as if they were crashing up against each other. Their voices were crashing up against each other. It was lovely. And I was like, I told my mom, never mind that the application date had already passed. I was like, I want to go to Clark Atlanta. My mom's like, I'm from Chicago. She's like, are you sure you want to go away so far? I eventually, thankfully, ended up here at the University of Illinois, but that's where it began, in high school. I grew up singing in church, but I didn't take it really seriously. High school is what did that for me. And then when I came to the University of Illinois, my advisor told him I liked to sing, I like music. They were like, you're going to be in Black Chorus.
Like Reginald, Quandra Clark's passion for music started at a young age through her role as a singer, principal accompanist, and assistant director of the University of Illinois Black Chorus. Quandra and Reginald say it's more than just music. It's a community.
I've been singing in church all my life. I grew up singing in church with my family. And then as a teenager, I realized that I actually had a natural talent. I had a natural gift to be able to sing music. And that's something that I grew to love. By the time I got to college and I joined the Black Chorus, I was able to be under the leadership of Dr. Davis, who helped to develop me into the musician that I am today. To me, it's about community. I enjoy singing. And when I have the opportunity to sing with others, it just gives me joy inside.
Let's send the message to glory, say Lord, you will
hear. There's just such a rich musical legacy. You all have someone on the wall downstairs that I really respect and admire, Willie T. Somerville. I can't say that name enough. He very much welcomed me into the community. He was my piano teacher for one lesson. From him, I got the hymnal that I still use. I still play the piano from. It's the Total Praise hymnal. It's a navy blue hymnal. And there's such a rich musical legacy here in Urbana-Champaign that I don't know if people have really tapped into, particularly in the community. So many singers who sing at such a high level. And what I feel so bad about is that we don't quite give them their recognition that they're due. So there's just so much here that I had to come back. I had to come back because there's so many people that I love and respect who are making music, making strides in the industry, which is beautiful. And I want everybody to know that they're connected in this musical lineage here at Illinois.
Is there a certain piece that encapsulates the tradition and history of Black sacred music that you are looking forward to performing?
Artist V. Michael McKay, we are doing a medley of some of his traditional music, specifically All in His Hands is the title of the piece. He wrote it years and years ago, but he's actually one of the people who inspired me from coming to Symposium. I've actually been a part of Symposium for over 20 years now. So I believe this is my 12th Symposium, but just being there, studying the different artists that come, I am now a songwriter myself.
Lift Every Voice and Sing. It tells the story of Black sacred music. It tells the story of American history. It tells the story of Western European history, right? There's so many things, battles we've had to overcome. And I think the most important thing that we can do is remember, right? At Yale, I'm taking a class with Bishop William Barber, a civil rights activist. And one of the things that he shares in class is that America's one of the only countries that doesn't want to audit their history because it's a painful history, right? Obviously. But I want people to consider that the music can be a vehicle for us tracing that history. Lift every voice and sing till earth and heaven ring, ring with the harmonies of liberty. Let our rejoicing rise high as the listening skies. Let us march on till our victory is won, right? It's an encouraging message. It's an inclusive message. As I said before, we want everybody to just, you don't have to harp on things, but you can really think critically about them. And I think the music relaxes you. It helps you just lay back. And if you listen to the words, you've got the entire story. The music will tell the story every time. This is like my family, so I feel like I'm coming home. So that's why I had to come.
Oh, I love that.
Thank you.
I love that.
Facing the rock.
Black sacred music reminds us of our story, where we came from, and reminds us that we can do it. It's a testament to preserving our culture and recognizing the pillar and the strength that Black stories carry in the midst of global uncertainty. As Black History Month just ended, the Dialogue team looks into the future, and we're reminded of these stories, of our history, and that our music is our testimony. Later on in the show, you'll hear more about the NAACP, from the ashes of Springfield's brutal massacre that birthed the NAACP 117 years ago, to today's challenges under Trump's second term. Witness their unwavering fight and discover the passionate deliberations behind their coveted Image Award selections. For Dialogue, I'm Kennedy Vincent.